Lord Cornwallis, the British commander there, defeated the American army that came down there to subdue him and would have dragged South Carolina back into the Union with Britain. But he was frustrated in that attempt by primarily one man, one soldier, from the little Petey region north of Charleston. His name was Francis Marion, and he was the son of Huguenots who had fled from France in the previous generation and had come to South Carolina and had established a business there and become very profitable. And Francis Marion had grown up in that family as a French Reformed Christian. And he, not single-handedly, but certainly made the major contribution to holding South Carolina into the United States in the midst of that war. On George Washington's staff was a man by the name of Lorenz, who was fluent French speaker. And the Lorenz family came to South Carolina as Huguenots in the previous couple generations, actually three generations prior. And one of them became, I think, one of the presidents of Congress, and two of them served on George Washington's personal military staff and enabled him to communicate with the French troops, which were Catholics, who were sent by the French king to help America win their independence. The more you dig into American history, especially colonial, the more you're going to run into the Huguenots and their children and their grandchildren. And there is a reason why they came to America, and that reason is the Reformation in France eventually resulted in the destruction of the French Protestant Church, not altogether destroyed, but in large measure the persecution in the end, in the 17th century, drove out hundreds of thousands of the very best men and women of France, and they went to South Africa and rejuvenated the culture of South Africa. They went to Germany, they went to England. Wherever the Huguenots went, they enriched the societies that they were a part of, because they tended to be the skilled, the educated, the ones who could contribute to everything from political issues to military. And in the United States, that was true more than any other country in the world. So to the Huguenots, the United States has always been able to give great thanks for those who came. Just north of Richmond, Virginia, where I live, is a little town called Huguenot Springs. And the Huguenots that came to Virginia in the colonial period settled in their own little settlement there. And it is still there. If you visit Charleston, South Carolina, there is a Huguenot church, and they're very proud of their heritage, and once a year they preach in French, and they use their hymnals are the Geneva hymnals by John Calvin, and they use the John Calvin liturgy still, Sunday by Sunday. Everything in the church is right out of the French Reformation, except the preaching. The Huguenot preaching today in Charleston, South Carolina, well, you might as well read the front page of the newspaper. For those of you who don't remember what newspapers are, there are things that used to be purchased in the morning for old people to find out what was going on in the world. But the pulpit ministry there today is pretty sorry, but the rest of the service is right out of John Calvin and the French Huguenots. France also had Christians. I mean, France was considered a Christian nation. It was a key country in Christendom. The church came there very early on. The apostolic witness was in France in the first century of the church. And, of course, France then wasn't called France. It was Gaul, and it was conquered by Julius Caesar and part of the Roman Empire. But when the Christian church came along, there was a great deal of gospel witness that came there. And after a few centuries, the entire area became part of Christendom. One of the interesting things about France and the French crown is this, that the French king, starting with Charlemagne, took on the title of his Christian majesty. And the French kings typically considered themselves superior to the Pope. As a matter of fact, when a French king was crowned, starting with Charlemagne, Napoleon took the crown from the Pope and put it on his own head. French kings, the very first thing they did when they became a king was celebrate Mass, led by them. Because the French king was the head of the church in France, not the Pope, in a practical sense, in a very real sense. So the papacy and the Roman church down through the centuries had a terrible time with France. Not because France wasn't Catholic and France didn't believe, it's just that the French kings were so closely tied with the Catholic Church that he often considered himself far superior to the papacy. And that's going to be true right up until the French Revolution. And so the church was there early, it was strong, and the French monarch was intimately involved in making sure that Roman Catholic orthodoxy was the religion of France. But in the Middle Ages, in the early Middle Ages, along came a number of different reformers. In fact, that's going to be the case in the French church down through the years, that there are going to be small groups of reformed, usually preachers, priests, friars, who try to recall the church, at least to some extent, back to its apostolic roots. And among these reform movements, one of them took hold, and it lasted all the way up to the Reformation, in fact, a little beyond the Reformation. And it was in the very early days, and the people were known as the Poor of Lyon, and they were followers of a very elusive figure that today is known as Peter Waldo. And his name was probably Valdez or Valdez, and he was living in Lyon in 1180. So in the early 12th century, there was a man who was apparently a wealthy merchant, and he became convicted about the wealth of the church and the way that it drew people away from Christ by his observation, and so he sold everything and began preaching poverty. The church always got nervous when the preachers started preaching about poverty. And there were great debates that were held in the Vatican and in different parts of the church over questions like, did Christ own the cloak that he wore? And the Franciscans said, no, he didn't. And the Dominicans said, yes, of course he did. And they would debate those kinds of questions over wealth because the papacy was accumulating these gold and silver, et cetera. Well, the Waldensians began as the Poor of Lyon in 1180, followers of Peter Waldo. And what he stressed is what we come to find out, that a lot of these reform movements, and especially the Reformation, beyond all else, stressed. And that was that the Bible is the standard for truth for the church and for the Christian. And everyone should read the Bible and study it and see it's God's word to man. It is without error, and it gives you what is totally necessary for life and faith and practice. And that's what apparently this Valdez, known as Peter Waldo, and his followers became known as Waldensians. That's what he believed, that the Bible really set the standards. And lo and behold, reading the Bible and learning more and more truth and comparing it with what the church was, where he was, at least in Lyon, was very different from what he saw in the scriptures. And so he kind of began a movement away from those doctrines in the Catholic Church. And at first he was greeted with open arms. Another reformer, reform's good. It usually sets out to purify the church, and that's a good thing. Except that he couldn't find the Pope in the Bible. And he couldn't find praying to the Virgin Mary. And on down the list, no purgatory, a number of things. And over time, they became noticed because the poor preachers of Lyon began traveling through France with the gospel. They started preaching that salvation was by grace alone and by faith alone. Uh-oh. And so the church went after them, and the Waldensians went underground. And they went underground for, really, literally, for centuries. They were condemned by the papacy by 1184. They were excommunicated. The anathemas were pronounced against them in 1215. And on it goes. They rejected, of course, the church hierarchy, and the Fourth Lateran Council had condemned them as heretics, which then made them open game for execution. And a lot of what we know about the Waldensians in France comes from the court records of the Inquisition. And most of the people who were involved in Waldensian churches that were established were very simple, poor folk who didn't know all the big theological words. They knew what they believed. They knew what the Bible taught. But when the Inquisition put them on the hot seat, they knew just how to ask the questions to get them to make heretical answers. And it didn't take long to condemn them and to take them out and burn them at the stake. And so that's what became sort of common practice. The Waldensians, however, did not sit still for it. And they moved all over Europe. They took the gospel. They took the gospel to Bohemia and to the German states. They took especially up into the Tyrol and into Italy and the Alps and the French Alps in southeastern southwestern France were just full of Waldensians. And the movement grew through the centuries. They could never quite stomp them out. In fact, the Pope declared crusades against the Waldensians, and they sent armies up into the mountains of France to exterminate the Waldensians, and they were just patently unsuccessful at it. A few of them always survived and moved farther up the hill to build their villages. They were hardworking people. They had big families, and they passed on from generation to generation the gospel. Now, if we were to sit down with medieval Waldensian and find out what they believe, we'd say, well, we believe about half of what you believe, and the other half, you're wrong. So they still had a lot of error mixed with the truth, but in their heart of hearts, it appears historically that they were true Christian people seeking to spread the gospel, however many odd ideas they had accumulated to go along with that. And the Waldensians lasted, right up until modern times. And when the Reformation came, somehow they came in contact with the Swiss reformers. And a number of Waldensian preachers went around and compared what they believed with what the reformers were teaching. And they identified immediately with John Calvin. And so a number of the Waldensian churches were just kind of folded into the Calvinist Reformation, and many of them became Huguenots. We'll get to in just a second. Others, and there were still little pockets of them in Italy, of all places, where they got away with it. There's a very interesting, if you want to know more about the Waldensians, there are very few books on them, but there is a novel, a historical novel, entitled Rora, R-O-R-A. If you like reading historical novels and learning about church history, you can find out about the Waldensians in the book Rora. It's a true story about one village and one great leader of the Waldensians in the mountains who decided to defend themselves. And the Catholic armies came to get them. And they set up all kinds of traps and ambushes up in the mountains to protect their people. And it's a very interesting story. And also, another crusade was announced by the Pope during the 1600s and the 1650s, another crusade against the Waldensians. This is 100 years after the Reformation. They're still being persecuted in France. And Oliver Cromwell heard about it, and he sent a letter to someone that he knew would get picked would be get captured and would be taken to the Pope. And so he wrote this letter for it intentionally to make its way to the papacy. And in the letter he said, if the Pope doesn't call off his dogs, the new model army is coming from England and we won't stop till we get to the Vatican and leave the Waldensians alone. And he sent that to somebody so it could get captured, and it did, and it went to the Pope, and the Pope called off his dogs and brought the Duke of Savoy and the other armies and pulled them down out of the mountains and got away from the Waldensians, lest the English Navy show up at Naples and Oliver Cromwell march on the Vatican. I would like to have seen that happen. It just would have been interesting to see the new model army have their way in Italy. Anyway, so the gospel was there, and there were believers in France. It was a big country, and there were lots of places to hide. Also, there are still Huguenots there. There's still a French Reformed Church. And so while I'm going to talk about what happened to the Huguenots and how they got dispersed, they still existed, and they still exist today. And they did exceptional, wonderful things during the Second World War in protecting Jews and working out the implications of the gospel in whole villages of Huguenots in the Piedmont region of France. So they were still around even in World War II, and there's some still there, the French Reformed Church. In fact, I believe they have a seminary even in Aix, La Provence. So the Huguenots themselves, the term is a little bit uncertain, but it's very similar. And most historians believe that it comes from the French word for Confederates. So I kind of like the word Huguenot now, too. It's probably derived from that French term. Well, the Reformation, of course, the French are like Texans in some way. You know, everything has to be bigger and better and first and et cetera. And the Reformation, they claim that, you know, the Reformation in France actually came there 4 years before Martin Luther posted his 95 Theses. Because there were men, scholars and priests, actually preaching the gospel. The exact same things that Luther did in Germany were already being preached in some of the universities and taught some of the universities in France, and that is true. Jacques Lefebvre d'Eppel was one. And the Bishop William Briconnet of Meaux, that's M-E-A-U-X, but the Bishop of Meaux was preaching salvation by faith as a bishop of the area, and he was training other students and priests and putting them in places where they could preach the gospel. And this is just prior to Martin Luther. And so there were those who had taken the very simple basics of the gospel and were already teaching them to those in the universities especially. In 1534, there was an incident that happened that really brought the wrath of the French crown and the papacy down on those who were starting to accept the reform in France. And it's called the Placards Incident. And in this particular case, a number of French Protestants had taken placards and spread them around university. And it was a savage attack on the Eucharist. That is, they were attacking their view of the Roman Catholic view of the Mass and the Eucharist. And that struck at the heart of the entire system. I mean, that was at the bottom of everything, was the role of the priest, the role of the bishop, the role of the clergy as intermediaries between the congregations and Christ, and the fact that they performed the miracle of the Mass and all of that. And so these Protestants, probably students, made up a bunch of placards arguing that those were signs of the Antichrist, and they spread them all over the university and secretly. And when it was discovered, the French king began a systematic rounding up of professors and students who were teaching what they said, they're no longer just heretics, which the French king, frankly, could live with. But now they're rebels. And they're really striking at the heart of France by challenging the celebration of the Mass. And so the roundup began. And this is going to happen throughout the whole period, that there are times when the French crown is just going to crack down on anybody who had Protestant sympathies. There were times when the king looked the other way. There were times when there was at least a practical degree of toleration of French Protestants. But that's not going to be the standard. 25-year-old John Calvin was one of those men who had been involved in hearing that preaching and teaching. And he fled the country and ended up eventually in Geneva in Switzerland. But he had come under sway of a French preacher, William Farrell, and of Martin Bucer. And Frenchman John Calvin published the Institutes of the Christian Religion, 1536. Now, that's some kind of work done by a man who's 26 years old when he wrote the Institutes of the Christian Religion. If you've ever read the Institutes or used it, I recommend it to you. It is, in some ways, the heart of the Reformation theologically stated, and it was dedicated to the King of France by John Calvin, and it was Orthodox theology. It was Reformed theology in its very core and in essence, and still stands today, and is actually read in Reformed seminaries anyway, because it has such great, great value. And it certainly triggered and reached the hearts of many, many people in France. So the Reformation did progress, and it progressed exponentially in France. John Calvin continued to train young men and send them to France. It's estimated that between 1560 and 1570, there were about 1,200 Protestant churches in France with almost 2 million members. And that's 1560 to 1570. That's the decade that Charles II went back to England, the Restoration, and the persecution of the Covenanters. And that was all part of that same time period. So in America, you've got the second generation of Puritans in New England, and you've got the persecution of the Covenanters in Scotland, and you have the Reformed Church of France, the Huguenots, growing exponentially across an area of France called the Midi, M-I-D-I, and it's a big archipelago through France. There are certain regions of France that just went over to Protestantism wholesale. And it's interesting that in France, a large percentage of the converts, people that were converted to Christ, that joined the Reformation, that supported it, a large percentage of them were gentlemen, were nobles of the nobility of France, men who were of wealth and substance, merchants especially. In fact, the Reformation in France spread in large measure by merchants who carried Reformed literature. You know, everybody was an itinerant salesman in those days, and there were these we'd call them marketers and traveling salesmen all over France, going between England and Scotland and the Netherlands and France and Spain and Switzerland and Italy, and everybody had to cross through France going and the Reformation appealed to a lot of these businessmen. And they carried Bibles with them and distributed them. They carried literature that they sold and that they gave away all across France. And so the Reformation grew and grew, and the Catholic Church couldn't stop it. They didn't know what to do. They didn't even know where it was coming from. And a lot of it was just businessmen sharing the gospel with their clients as they traveled. Some of it was just itinerant preachers coming down out of the Swiss Alps with their newfound faith that they had learned from the preaching of John Calvin and others. There were no Protestants in and there are very few Protestants anyway in Paris, and some of the wine regions to the north. The wine regions in the early parts of the Reformation in France didn't respond because so much of their wine went to the priests and to the monks and was used in celebrating the Mass every single day. They had to have wine. Of course, they didn't give it to the people. Only the priests could take the wine, and they took it in great abundance. And so the winery regions tended to stiff-arm the Reformation. It's an interesting observation. I don't know what it has to do with anything, but it just happens to be that some of the wine regions were like that. Others were not. But the Midi, where most Protestants were found, were from La Rochelle on the coast, a large Protestant city as it became, in a southern arc to Bordeaux and Toulouse, to Montpellier and Lyon, Languedoc, Provence, and Dauphine. Those were all Protestant provinces. In fact, they say that Normandy became the biggest Protestant stronghold in all of France, right there on the coast. You may have heard of it. There were very few Protestants in Picardy, although that's where John Calvin was from. I've been to his home there in Picardy. Very few Protestants, though. Champagne and Brittany, few Protestants. But this great big arc right through eastern France and up into the Piedmont Mountains became solid Protestants. At first, mostly urban. It was mostly people lived in towns and cities, and mostly literate people, like printers and booksellers. Very key people to the spread of the gospel. God saw to it that happened. Just as a side note, there were certain professions that went over to the Reformation on a large scale, grand scale. Printers and booksellers were one of them. Another one were the weavers in the cotton industry, where they would sit at looms all day. And this was true in England, too. Almost the entire weaving industry became reformed in England during the early days of the Reformation there. And one of the reasons was that they had access to Bibles and literature, and they could sit at their looms and prop a book or a tract or a pamphlet on their loom. And it was mindless work in some ways. They just sat all day weaving and reading. And that was one of the major reasons that the weaving industry went over to the Reformation so strongly, is that they had time and opportunity to read in the vernacular. And that happened in France as well. So there are certain areas and certain groups, but especially in urban town settings. So that means the most conservative areas of France, the ones that were the most Catholic and the most hidebound in their religion, were the peasants. And that's going to be true in Ireland, too. It's the illiterates. It was the ones who are illiterate, who are utterly dependent upon their parish priest for birth, marriage, burial, and everything in between. They're the ones who are the most resistant to the coming of the gospel and to change. So it's really the rural peasantry of France digs in and refuses to hear the gospel. Ironically, during the French Revolution, they do the same thing to the French Revolution. French Revolution comes along, and who resists it to the death? French peasants. Because the French Revolution wants to destroy the Catholic Church. And they die by the thousands in the French Revolution, defending their churches and their priests in the countryside of France. So the most conservative group. And that was true of the Reformation. Those who could read, those who were educated, those who had financial ability, those sorts of people were the ones who tended to listen and be converted. There are a number of names in France that are associated with the Huguenot movement and the French Church, and their names would just go by you if I started reading them. But I am going to deal with one of their greatest leader of all. I am going to talk about, as well as the Prince de Condé, who was of royal blood. Members of the king's family became reformed. And there are different kings that come and go during this time. I mean, they're kings for 20 years, and then the next king comes up. And to go through all the kings of France, again, it would just be a bunch of names. But with the realization that none of the kings of France are going to leave the Catholic Church, even though one of the French kings during the Reformation and the post-Reformation era is going to be a Protestant. He's a Protestant nobleman. He's an heir to the throne. He's a defender of the Reform and a Huguenot of Huguenots. And the king dies and he becomes the king. Well, he can't become the king unless he's Catholic. And he's the one who famously said, I think Paris is worth a mass. And so he went back to the Catholic Church so he could become the King of France. But as the King of France and a loyal member of the Catholic Church, he protected Protestants and gave them a number of years of opportunity for survival and for building their churches and for preaching the gospel. A former Protestant gone back to the Catholic Church. And so that only happened one time. All the rest of the French kings were bitterly opposed to the Reformation. The family name that weaves in and out of the story and has already done so in the history of England and France and Scotland is the Guise family. Two families, the Medicis and the Guise families were hidebound Roman Catholic loyalists, especially the Guises. And both the Medicis and the Guises were involved in French politics at the highest levels. They were noble families. They were super wealthy, super powerful, and a lot of their strength and heritage went back to Rome. There were a number of popes who were Medicis, and the Guise family were at the same level. In fact, it's interesting. Mary, Queen of Scots, married a Guise prince, who then became the King of France. And they married when he was 16; she was 15, or something like that. And the old man, the king, not an old man, he accidentally got killed in a tournament. So they, you know, where the horses charge each other and they're carrying the lances. Some guy accidentally put his lance through the king's head and knocked him off his horse. So he had a lance in his eyeball and he broke his neck. And off he went, and we got a new king. And the new king was married to Mary, Queen of Scots. But then the young king, they were married a couple years, he died. And Mary ended up having to go back to Scotland. You start connecting these various providential incidents, and they kind of all collect in favor of the church at some point. You know, that's one of the principles of a providential view of history, and that is that the church is at the true church of Christ is at the center of history. You want to look at the past biblically, think of this question when you do, what is God doing in his church at this time? Well, this is the time of the Reformation. This is a time where even the secular historians have to come to grips with the great spiritual awakening that's taking place in Europe. And, of course, they explain it through all different other means. I mean, the Marxists have an explanation for it that's purely economic. The secularists have their explanations. Everybody has to use psychology to explain it, and mass hysteria and all kinds of things, because they're not allowed to talk about the Holy Spirit or try to explain true heart religion, as the Puritans would call it, taking place on such a massive scale. So the Reformation is an interesting topic for secular historians to wrestle with, because it has this huge religious component that they don't have a rational explanation for, because their eyes are blind. In any case, Henry II died. Francis II, his 15-year-old son, married to Mary Stuart, became the King of France. And the result was the Guise family seized control of the treasury, of the church, of the military, of the diplomatic corps. Francis's mother was Catherine de' Medici, and she had four sons, all of which she wanted to become king someday. Antoine de Bourbon, the King of Navarre, and Louis de Bourbon, the Prince of Condé, were both in that kingly line also, opposed to the Guise family. So it was the Bourbons against the Guise. The Bourbons were Protestants. They're French Reformed Church. So the Prince de Condé and the King of Navarre, both French Protestants. Of course, Navarre is going to switch sides. The Huguenots were labeled seditious rebels to be rooted out. And in order to maintain peace and public tranquility, the King of France carried on at different times efforts to try and extirpate the Huguenot presence. And the way the Huguenots dealt with it was this, and it's called the Doctrine of Interposition. Huguenot theorists, Huguenot teachers, spent a lot of time writing on government and the biblical view of government. And they developed, in particular, the Doctrine of Interposition. And it is this, because it comes into play big time among the Scots and then real big time among Americans. Because Americans take this Huguenot argument from the scriptures and they use it against the King of England at the time of independence. And it's in a book that was written in France called the Vindicii Contra Tyrannis, the Vindication Against Tyranny, written by a French polemicist and biblical scholar, and it's called the Vindicii, and just in shorthand. But I'll tell you who referenced it and who loved it and who read it was John Adams. So the Huguenots did a lot of deep thinking on political issues, more than any other of the Reformed world. And this doctrine of interposition is this, that if, and this goes to some things we said earlier today, it is this, that if a monarch or a superior member of the civil magistrates, whether it be a king, a prince, or whomever, a president, when they exercise tyranny against the people of the country, the lesser magistrates have a responsibility to stand between the people and the higher authorities, because they're legitimate too. A magistrate that is the mayor of a city or the governor of a province is just as much a man put in authority by God as the king is, or the commander of the army, or whoever's in charge politically. You have all these lesser magistrates, and they're just as authentic and just as in positions put there by God as anybody is. And so when tyranny rises up and comes down against the people, it's the responsibility of the lesser magistrates to interpose themselves between the people to protect them and the higher authorities, because they have authority too from God in their particular civil positions. It's called the Doctrine of Interposition. The man who articulated it best in the United States was John C. Calhoun, great-great-grandson of Huguenot immigrants to South Carolina. And he's the one who defended that doctrine in Congress, in the Senate, and it's the one that the Confederacy used in their demands for independence in 1861. They talked about interposition. This was something that the Huguenots were the ones who developed this doctrine, and that's what they used to defend themselves against tyranny. But if there hadn't been any lesser magistrates that were Christians, or that were Huguenots, shall we say, if there hadn't been any, the Huguenots would not have rebelled. They would not have defended themselves, because it wouldn't have been legitimate for them in their way of thinking. But the lesser magistrates had a responsibility to interpose themselves. And so that's what took place. So when the king, and by the way, no standing army, France doesn't have a French army. There's only one country in Europe that has an army at this time, the time of the Reformation. There's only one standing army, and it belongs to Spain. And the 1500s we look at as the century of the Reformation. The rest of the world looks at it as the century, they call it the Spanish century, because that's when Spain's explorers and conquistadors came to America, and they conquered all of South America and Central America and all kinds of other places around the world, the Philippines. The Spanish were everywhere, and they were, of course, all that gold and silver that they were mining out of South America was coming back to Spain to pay for their army, because they had the only big standing professional army. So wherever Spain went, people quaked because they were going up against the pros. So when the French king wants to go to war against his own people, against the Huguenots, who are mostly in Western France, he's got to hire soldiers. He has to go out and he has to buy mercenaries. It's the only way the French king can fight a war, is to purchase mercenary armies, which he does. What was their specialty? Different armies had different small countries had professional soldiers who were specialized in various sorts of arms. And some of them were Italian states, the Venetians and the Florentines and others had little professional mercenary soldiers who specialized in stuff. And the Pope had his own army, of course. And the King of France would hire these various groups. The Swiss had all kinds of them. Usually it was the Swiss. The French hired the Catholic Swiss mercenaries to come and fight for France. So there were all these various combinations of mercs that they got from other parts of Europe to attack the Huguenots and to wipe out the Reformed Church in France. But wars, as I said, are very, very expensive. And mercenaries in particular like to be paid. They like to be paid what they ask, and they like to be paid on time. And if they don't, they might just burn the town to the ground and take everything, which is what they do. And so the French king has always got worries about his army because they're not really his men. He's buying them for this particular occasion. And so there are a series of wars in France. There are civil wars of a sort. But the king has actually declared war against the Reformed Church, and has raised armies to kill them off. And the Huguenots, many of whom are of the nobility and are automatically interposing themselves between the crown, who's just another nobleman who's been jumped up to king, and the Catholic Guise family that's bringing in all of their retainers to support the war, etc. And so the Protestants had some very able men who defended them and who organized armies of Huguenots to defend themselves. Suddenly a French army would descend on them. The king's troops would come and they would fight a battle. The Huguenots lost some of the wars. We say that when the Huguenots fought for their liberty, they literally did. And it was all self-defense. They never started a war. They never invaded anybody. They never tried to overthrow the king. They merely tried to keep their people alive and protect their parts of France where they lived. And that's what they did, and they did it with great success. And what would happen is the king would run out of money, and he'd call for a truce. And so they would sign a treaty. Treaties lasted until the French king could collect enough money to hire another army. That's how long the treaties lasted. And they all had a different name, but they would make a treaty with the Huguenots, and sometimes they would make concessions. The king would say, you're allowed to worship in these following towns, but you can't build a church building, or things like that. There was always negotiations going on back and forth, and until he could save enough money to go at them again. And in the meantime, those mercenaries are on their own. And what do you do with 5,000 reprobate teenagers that don't even speak the language, and they've been turned loose on the countryside of a very wealthy country with lots of small towns, and nobody can stop them? And they just run amok all through France, and that's a problem the king has to deal with too. So when he goes to war, he has to consider lots of different aspects of trying to exterminate his own citizens because they trust in Christ alone for their salvation. But that's seen as treason and as rebellion against the government. So a series of wars are fought with many battles, and the Prince of Condé was from, and he might be on the throne at some point. He's from Picardy. Coligny, Admiral de Coligny, I'm going to talk about him in conclusion here, of Normandy, and La Rochefoucauld from Poitou, and the Prince of Rohan, not from Lord of the Rings, is from Brittany, although he is the inspiration for Rohan in Lord of the Rings. So a number of civil wars are fought between the Duke of Guise and the King of France against the various bases of strength of the Huguenots. Orléans was the Protestant base of operations. Later it's going to be actually La Rochelle. The last great battles will be fought in the Siege of La Rochelle. I'm not going to go through all the wars and all the battles that were fought. The king's armies were defeated. In some cases, the Huguenots were defeated, but they stayed in the field. They actually had a really good leadership. And the man who led them at least through the first four civil wars, the man who was the champion of the Huguenots, was the Admiral of France. The Admiral of France is the highest-ranking military guy in France, and he's from the Coligny family. It's a very highly placed, highly respected noble family of France at the time. So he's called Admiral de Coligny, Gaspard de Coligny, and his mother began preparing him to be a great man when he was just little. She educated him to be a leader, taught him to be a man who was widely read, who understood the martial arts, who understood art and literature, but understood how to fight and how to lead. And he was trained from his youth like that. Now, his older brother, who was technically going to inherit and should have been getting this training, his older brother wasn't particularly interested in those things. And so she sent him to the church. He became a bishop. They purchased a bishopric for him. And he became a bishop because he liked peace and quiet and no problems or struggles. But the admiral was a young man that his mother recognized that he had leadership qualities, and she trained him to take his place in the leadership of France. And he did. He became the admiral of France under the king. But when the king, and then he was converted, and then when the king went to war with the Huguenots, Admiral de Coligny stepped up and became the leader of the French Protestant church, the military leader, the grand strategist, among other things. And so a tremendous man whose life is worth studying. His character was sterling and superb. He created a number of things. He was an innovator in military tactics and strategy. He created the first ambulance corps to pick up the wounded after the battle. Nobody had ever done that before. They just let them bleed out. Or wait till the townspeople come out and cut the throats of all the wounded and take all their stuff. I mean, that's the way battles were fought. This is the Middle Ages, or it's the end of the Middle Ages. But that's the way wars were fought. And if you were wounded in battle, you were a dead duck. Unless your brother was there and he picked you up and carried you off or something. He set up an ambulance corps so that wounded Huguenots could be taken to hospitals. And he set up a system of hospitals. First time, military hospitals. New concept. And it's the 16th century. And then he was innovative in his tactics on the battlefield. But also, the admiral was an outstanding Christian man, and he foresaw, in fact, he saw the necessity of spreading the gospel to other parts of the world. He saw what the French, or he saw what the Spanish were doing in the New World. And he said, we can do that too. We can go to the New World, and we can preach the gospel to the Indians, and we can establish little French plantations where we can transfer our Reformed Protestant culture to the New World. So he sent out an expedition to Brazil, and they established in a place in Brazil where there were no Portuguese around. They established a French colony in Brazil. And as it turns out, the man who was chosen to lead that was a closet Catholic and a secret agent for the Guises. He ended up terminating the colony by killing the preachers. And the survivors made it back to France. And went to Calvin, as a matter of fact, because Calvin was involved in that plantation, too. So the admiral then sent another expedition, and this time they landed in La Florida, which the Spaniards claimed, but nobody was there. They didn't have any colony there. And so the French came, and they actually started a colony in Florida. It's Jacksonville, Florida. And they built a fort there. Our February history tour, this is part of it. We go to the Huguenot Fort Jacksonville. And that's where the French Reformed Church tried to plant the gospel and bring French culture. And they established good relations with the native tribes around there. They didn't just go in and start massacring them, as the Spaniards often did. They didn't have anything to steal. The Spaniards learned that the hard way. But this little colony, when Spain found out about it, the King of Spain, Philip II, sent his most experienced conquistador with a band of cutthroats to kill all the Frenchmen in Florida, and he did. He succeeded. A number of them did escape back to France, and it's an unbelievable story about Fort Caroline in Florida. You know, look at that sometime. That was the Admiral of France sending a Christian French expedition, Protestants, to the New World to spread the gospel, to bring the Reformation to the New World. It did not succeed. That got wiped out too. And so on it continued until my birthday, August 24th, St. Bartholomew's Day. And on that day, there was a wedding in Paris. And the admiral was invited, and all the Protestant nobility of France were invited to this royal wedding, and with safe conduct passes. And the Guise family plotted behind the king's back with his tacit approval to assassinate de Coligny and everybody else that had any Protestant connections, or anybody's neighbor that they didn't like at the time, because that's what happens when those kinds of things get started and get out of hand. Anybody you don't like, you call them a Protestant and kill them. And that's what happened. It's called the massacre in 1572 on St. Bartholomew's Day, August 24th. And the royal wedding of Marguerite to Henry of Navarre. And 3 days of massacre and pillage took place in Paris. They assassinated the admiral and all of his entourage, and every Protestant they could get their hands on. And then it broke out from Paris and all across France. It became open season on any Huguenots that you knew. And it's estimated that multiple thousands of French Protestants were murdered on the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. And the church was never again really the same. It had a very profound effect. In fact, a number of Huguenots gave up the faith and went back to the Catholic Church. when they saw the ferocity and the butchery that the French were capable of, the French Catholics were capable of. Well, some of them survived it. Many of them survived it and even continued. The persecution, Sixth Civil War, Seventh Civil War, Eighth Civil War, which lasted the longest and was the bloodiest, that was in 1584 to 1593. And eventually, the Edict of Nantes was issued in 1598, which said that there can be temporary religious coexistence. That's what they called it. The Huguenots were made legal in 1598 by the Edict of Nantes because they had a Protestant king who converted to Catholicism, but was able to get this passed. And so suddenly the Reformed Church was given a reprieve after eight civil wars, 1898 and 1598. And of course, that king wasn't long for this world either, and the Edict of Nantes was revoked by Louis XIV a little bit later on, and the persecution continued. The Huguenots, after the fall of New Rochelle in the 1600s, the last bastion of Huguenot resistance to being slaughtered was the city of New Rochelle. Catholics laid siege to it. King Charles in England was supposed to send a relief force to help them survive, and of course he dragged his feet, and it didn't happen, and New Rochelle fell. And that really was the end of the Huguenots as far as tolerance was concerned or being really a part of French society. And multiple hundreds of thousands had already left. And the fall of New Rochelle, what was the year of that? 1627, 1628 was really the end of Huguenots in France as a connected, growing body of Christians of the Reformed faith. Then they became scattered, small congregations here and there, and some survived till today. And as I said, they gave very good account of themselves in the Second World War, protecting Jews and others from the Germans after France fell. But the story of the Huguenots is a long and sorry and bloody tale. But the effect of it in the end was to send some of the greatest people of Europe, the greatest Christians of Europe, to other countries all over the world where they enriched those countries and their cultures. And their descendants were intimately involved in the American War for Independence and the successful securing of the American Republic. So as far as the United States is concerned, the Huguenots coming here was a great, great boon in the long run to the nation. Although there weren't many, the ones who came were made tremendous contributions to our own nation. And that happened wherever they went, especially in South Africa, too. So the story of the Huguenots is not one of the great success stories in some ways of the Reformation, because they were, in the end, they were defeated and they were driven out. And although they still remain, they still exist in small pockets. God wanted them in other places. And it was a hard way for them to have to go, but they did. After a century of very gallant, about a century of very gallant self-defense and propagation of the gospel and seeking to live within the boundaries of French society and French law, but the animosity of the French kings and the Catholic Church was too much to overcome in France. And so it remained a Catholic country, at least for another 100 and some years, when the French Revolution came and turned it into a pagan country. And when the French Revolution did come, there wasn't the kind of resistance that would have been provided had the Huguenots been there. There might not have been a French Revolution had the Huguenots not been driven out of the country. It might not have happened. Just speculation, but a wonderful example of God's graciousness on France, even though it was a time of great hardship. God was moving them around to different places, and left some in place. And there are some there today. Thank you.